I mean a significant person's expectation of another somehow gets realized. If you're a significant person, if you're a teacher or a father or something like that. Roger Bannister, for instance, when he broke the 4-minute mile back in 1954, he really didn't believe he could do it. But his coaches and his teammates believed that he could, and it was that transfusion of faith that made him go ahead and do that. And that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about a transfusion of faith. Steve Cawthon, the 3-time jockey champ, said that horses can even read it. They know how you sit in a saddle, how you come down the stretch, how you use the whip, whether you believe they're going to make it or not, or whether you believe they actually can do it. You telegraph that to them by your action. And I think there's a lot to be said for that same thing in this. Andy Greeley, regardless of his letter in the NCR, he's really not that way when you talk to him. He wrote, after his dealing with young people, and he was very successful for a long time in dealing with it, something that I think is really one of his finer things. It's an example of whether you like the person or not. He has some profound insights in certain things. Listen to this on the whole question of this believing in young people especially. He says, "As I reflect back on my years of working with young people, I regretfully conclude that I tended to miss the point completely." That's really a confession on Andy's part. "What young people need more than anything else is encouragement. My blood chills when I think of all the young people whom I might have encouraged, whom I might have assured of their own dignity and worth, in whom I might have made an act of faith, but failed to do so because I did not see that this above all else is what they were seeking. Oh, I surely pointed out the goals for them and paid lip service to their own ability to reach them. But in many, many cases, I failed to understand that the fact that they did not strive for the goals was no indication that they did not value them or did not want them, but simply showed that they did not have enough faith in their own ability to reach the goals or enough faith in their own goodness to achieve what the goals imply. I admit in all honesty that it will be a long, long time before I am able to excuse myself of this failure. But what is done, and there's no point in lamenting the past." Bravo, Andy. That's, I think, so true. And Jesus, again, is the model. A combination of John 14:12 and 15:16. "Whoever believes in me," said Jesus, "will do what I do. Yes, he will do even greater things." That's heresy. Heresy, you know, you say, me do greater things than Jesus? But that's exactly what Jesus is saying. We won't do them ourselves, but he will do them through us, of course. "I chose you and appointed you to go out and bear much fruit." And I thought that was such a good point that was made today in the homily, that there is such a thing as a gratuitous grace. You know that God is working through you, and you know you can't do it. I remember John Paul was sitting on a bed once, the edge of the bed, and he said, "I can't understand it. I can't understand it." He said, "Why would God work through me the way God obviously is?" John has a way of calling a spade. He said, "I don't deserve it." Of course, none of us deserve it. But God does work through us. And it's the old thing of Henry Nouwen, the wounded healer, that somehow we fall victim to that which we will later minister. Ask an AA, he'll tell you that all the time. What makes him a great minister is because he fell victim to the very thing to which he ministers. And, I could go on about Nouwen. I think he just is remarkable in his clarity and insight on certain things. Fourth point. And I'm going to move very rapidly here. Do we pray for our people, whether they're the staff of the parish, or our faculty, or our kids that we're working with, or whatever? Someone said, and you've heard it before, but it bears repeating, there comes a time when we stop talking to kids and people about God and start talking to God about the people and the kids. And I think that is really important, because I would say that If someone asks me, where do you experience God most in your life right now? I would have to say, in complete honesty, I could not say anything else. I would have to say, in the prayer of petition. Now, in the 60s, we just say, oh, get off of that gimme stuff. You know, God knows what you need and all that. Well, you can say that if you want to, but it just doesn't resonate with my own experience. I have experienced the presence of God so many times in my moments of weakness when I didn't know what to do or what to say. I remember once giving a talk, and it was a clergy conference in Chicago, 1,300 people, 7 bishops on the stage, and this guy gets up and he just lets fly, and he said, I want Father Link to answer this. He said, what about all these people who are violating the liturgy and carrying on like this, you know, and he goes on. And I just didn't even listen. I just started praying. And, you know, the butt of my response was, look, if they do that, you know, I'm sure it's through a desire to do what they think is right rather than any malicious thing. And I just pray and hope, as they do, that we can pass the faith on as well as pass on us. But I remember after it was over, I heard this patter of feet coming from behind. And it was Archbishop Cody. And he just said, I just want to thank you for diffusing a terrible situation, you know. I didn't do anything. I didn't know what the heck to do. And I think that was the best thing, because at that moment I just said, God, you're going to have to handle this, because this is a critical situation. And that happens all the time in my work right now. I had someone on the phone talk 35 straight minutes the other night, late. I said, oh, God. But somehow, after, you know, I just prayed. I didn't even listen. I held it over here because I was so tired of that I was going to say damn voice, that voice. But somehow, a voice said, you got to listen. Nobody's been listening to this person. You got to listen. I may regret it, but I just listen, you know. So anyway, I think that's the point I want to make there, that prayer is important in our ministry, and I think it has to be somehow related to our ministry, where we need help in a situation, because what I say to this person is going to be very important. Not that I'm important, but because I just happened by accident to be placed in that situation. The perfect model of this is Jesus himself. Jesus says, I pray for them not that you take them out of the world, but keep them safe from the world. And Jesus prayed for his disciples. He prayed for his ministry. He was a prayerful man, and it used to irritate me that none of my seminary professors pointed out how prayerful Jesus really was. And I went down and took a pencil and just started indicating all the places. And I was absolutely flabbergasted how prayerful Jesus was. Going off at the beginning of his ministry in the desert, then going off after his preaching to long before daylight, Mark says in 1:35, and praying. He prayed before he chose the 12 up the mountain all night. He prayed, you know, when they were saying, teach us to pray. He prayed on the cross, or in the garden. He prayed on the cross. He prayed at every operative moment in his life, at the Last Supper. Always at those operative moments, you find Jesus at prayer. That leads to the final point, and I want to wind it up here, is let's try to deal creatively with people rather than the prosaic way that we sometimes do it. A classic example was Melvin Willett was teaching a class of ethics in a public school, and he was talking about the Charles Van Doren show, you know, the rigged show. This is before the movie came out. And the kids said, well, what's wrong with that? It's entertainment. You know, and he said, you got to be kidding. He said they were deceiving everybody. Everybody was believing that this was on the up and up. And he said, well, that's their show. They can do whatever they want. And he thought, I'm never going to get through to these kids. So he just left it go. 2 weeks later, he gave them a test. It was terrible. And I think one or two kids passed. And he said, they wouldn't have passed if I hadn't helped. The guy said, would you run that by me again? He says, I said they would not pass if I hadn't helped. He said, well, then this, you're not counting this. He said, of course I'm counting it. And you'll know I'll count it when you see it in your average. He said, that's not fair. He said, look, it's my show. I can do whatever I want. And it suddenly, you know, we can be very liberal as long as it doesn't clip our nose. But as soon as it clips our nose, it's a whole different story. And so he took a creative approach rather than argue with the kids, get everybody heated up. He said it's going to generate more heat than light, so I might as well drop it. We'll come back to it at an appropriate time. A great example of this I love, of all people, Charles Swindell has this in his Second Wind, Chuck Swindell. This girl writes back to her parents from college. Dear Mom and Dad, just thought I'd drop you a note to clue you in on my plans. I've fallen in love with a guy named Jim. He quit high school after grade 11 to get married. After a year, he got a divorce. We've been going steady, would you believe, for 2 whole months and plan to be married in the fall. Until then, I've decided to move into his apartment. Parentheses, I think I might be pregnant. At any rate, I dropped out of school last week, although I'd sure like to finish sometime in the future. Then on the next page, Mom and Dad, I just want you to know that everything I've written so far in this letter is false. None of it's true, but Mom and Dad, it is true that I got a C- in French and flunked math. That's making bad news sound like good news. You know. But it's a creative approach to the problem. The model of creativity of Jesus was Jesus, of course, in dealing with people. And I'll never forget Richard Wilson wrote a song called The Good Life. And he says, Jesus painted pictures in the mind. It was the way he let them see how things are supposed to be. He used the wine. He used the bread. He used the fish. He used the sea. Storyteller. Yeah, he was a storytelling kind. He painted pictures in the mind. It was the way he let them see how things were really supposed to be. And I think Robert Frost, in his Mark of Reason, or Mask of Reason, has God say to Job, society can never think things out. It has to see them acted out by people. And I think that's exactly what we've got to do in most of our cases, our teaching, is to try to teach in a concrete, especially with the young people, that model approach. Let them see what you want to get across, which you normally use an abstract approach in. The Reader's Digest said when they have a real difficult thing, this is back when in their prime, I think they've lost their prime myself, when they wanted to get across an important point, they waited for a story to come along that illustrated it, and they would build or piggyback off of that story, because it was the best way to get across something that was needed. I'm going to leave that at this point, and let's move over to the whole question of conversion. When the Holy Father left Denver in WYD 93, World Youth Day, he challenged the young people of Denver to lead the way for the young, rest of the world in two things. The first one was to undergo a conversion to Jesus Christ. And then he asked them, secondly, to lead the way for the rest of the world in developing a personal relationship with this Jesus Christ. And I really thought that was, he couldn't have picked out two better themes to do this. And this leaves us the important task, therefore, as ministers, to try to help young people, especially, undergo a conversion to Jesus Christ. So in this particular presentation, I'd like to make a few comments as I see it on conversion, mainly from my own reading and experience, and share that with you. My approach, therefore, is going to be documentary in the sense I'm going to try to use the very same words from the data that I'm drawing it from. When we think of conversion, we don't want to just necessarily think of going from non-belief, that is practical non-belief, because I think everybody has a residue of belief in them, to unbelief. We also mean going from, say, being a nominal Christian to a committed Christian. That's more the paradigm. Or being a committed Christian and becoming an exemplary Christian, as you will. But it's a whole continuum or spectrum. Conversion is something that continues in our life every moment, whether you're the Holy Father or whoever. Let me give you an illustration of each one of them. The first is from out of prison darkness. This was written by Star Daly, who was one of the earliest pioneers in the whole thing of prison reform. He writes in that particular article, "Picture, if you can, a man who lives exclusively for the execution of crime. Picture that. This man was me 40 years ago. I'll never forget the words of the judge who sentenced me to prison for the third and final time. The judge said, 'I know you are sick, and I know that more punishment is not the remedy. I don't know what else to do. Our helplessness is your hopelessness.' He says, I went to prison, got into trouble almost immediately, and was sentenced to the hole. The average time for a strong man in the hole is 15 days. At the end of which the doctor ends the sentence, this time came and went for me. Finally, I collapsed. As I lay near death on the ice floor of the cell, a strange thought came to me. I began to wonder what would have happened if I had used my powers for something other than destruction. What then followed is difficult to describe. I first began to dream disconnected dreams of Jesus Christ, the man I had tried to avoid all these years. He paused near my side, seemed to look right down into my eyes. In all my life, I have never seen or felt such love. Then I seemed to see all the people I had injured, or who had injured me. I poured out love on them, which seemed to heal their hurts. When I consciously returned to my dungeon environment, the state of my mind had completely changed. Before that experience, I was a calloused criminal. After it, I was completely healed of my criminal tendencies." Now, this man's final record of his life is a testimony of this. And I'll never forget, I picked up Peter Marshall, was a famous chaplain of Congress for years. He said, of Star Daly, he said, "He is the best living proof I've ever seen that a new creation in Christ is not just the old man patched up, but an altogether new person living in the same body." So that kind of a conversion, I think, is possible. But I hasten to say what Cardinal Newman said. He said, there's no such thing as a sudden conversion. He said, I think it's what's sudden is the realization that I've gone through conversion process. I'm sure Star Daly and all of this had that movement there. So that it was really true. There wasn't a sudden conversion, but the realization that he had gone through the steps is what was sudden. A second example. This is from Keith Miller down these. It's from Taste of New Wine. Keith is still on the lecture circuit. He said, I used to walk down, this is an example of going from what I would call nominal Christianity to committed Christianity. I used to walk down the street and suddenly would break into a cold sweat. I thought I might be losing my mind. One day it got so bad, I got in my company car and drove off. As I was driving through the tall pine wood country of East Texas, I suddenly pulled up beside the road and stopped. I remember sitting there in complete despair. I'd always had the feeling there was one more bounce in the ball. After a couple martinis and a good night's sleep, one could always start over tomorrow. But now there was no tomorrow in my situation. I was like a man on a great gray treadmill. As I sat there, I began to cry like a little boy, which I suddenly realized I was inside. I looked up toward the sky. There was nothing I wanted to do with my life. I said, God, if there's anything you want to do with this stinking soul, take it. This is almost 10 years ago, but something came into my life that day which has never left. There wasn't any flashing lights or visions, but it was a deep intuitive realization of what God wants from a man. And the peace which came with this understanding was the cessation of the conflict of a lifetime. I realized then that God does not want a man's money, nor does he primarily want his time, even his whole lifetime. He wants your will. And if you give him your will, he'll show you life as you've never seen it before. It is really like being born again. As I sat there, I continued to cry. Only now these tears were a release from a lifetime of being bound to myself. Although I could not understand nor articulate for many months what had happened to me, I knew to the core of my soul that I had somehow made contact with the very meaning of life. I started my car, and I headed for home. If you've ever read Born Again by Charles Colson, he had a very similar experience when he left the home of Tom Phillips, who was the president of Raytheon at the time. They built the Patriot missiles. And he said that he began to weep so loudly, and his eyes were so flooded with tears, he had to pull off the road. And the thing that was worrying him was that the Phillips, because he pulled off just a little patch of pine needles off of their driveway, it was 100 yards from the car, but he was crying so loudly, he said that he was afraid they'd hear him. And he said, I just kept saying, I don't know who you are. I don't know how to reach you, but all I can say is I want to do it. Take me, take me. And he said, didn't know what else to pray. I just kept saying that word, take me, take me, take me. It was like a mantra. And, Colson is still crisscrossing the country on campuses and prisons. And I saw his work. I've given a couple of retreats in prison. I've seen the effects of his work. And his book has got a lot of nice things in it. Like he said, his wife, who's Catholic, he said, I never asked her about confession or communion or mass, what those things meant to her, you know. And he said, of all the things that meant deep things to us, we never got to them. And I think that is a good example of how, you know, it takes a real critical or crisis situation to really open things up. One final example is Martin Luther King, an example of something where he went from being a committed to what I consider to be an exemplary Christian. One night toward the end of January, this is from Stride Toward Freedom, I settled into bed after a strenuous day. Coretta had been already fallen asleep, and just as I was about to doze off, the telephone rang. An angry voice said, "Listen, nigger, we've had all we want from you. Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery." I hung up, but could not sleep. It seemed that all my fears had come down on me at once. I had reached the saturation point. I got out of bed, began to walk the floor. Finally, I went to the kitchen and heated a pot of coffee. I was ready to give up. With cup of coffee sitting untouched before me, I tried to think of a way to move out of the picture without appearing to be a coward. In a state of exhaustion, when my courage had all but gone, I decided to take my problem to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership. If I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I cannot face it alone. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I have never experienced him before. I could give you a whole list. It was sort of a hobby with me all the way through the seminary to collect conversion stories, because that is really where everything's at, whether it's at a local individual level or whether it is at a corporate level, which is why I did this for you. That is what our country needs right now. It really needs to know about this thing, conversion, and people will help facilitate that, because most of the people are not bad people. They're just sort of, they're out of the church by default, not by design, in most cases. When you scratch beneath, you find a real believer. And I could give you many cases, and you could give me just as many of people like this. Anyway, as I looked at this example of daily going from non-belief, practical non-belief, to belief, or look at Miller going from nominal to committed, or Martin Luther King going from committed to exemplary, I could see in each one of those three moments, three very important moments. The first moment was what I called in my own mind the zero moment, when they understood, I need help. I really need help. Then there came that surrender moment where they had to come to the point where they asked for help. That would be the surrender moment. Then the power moment came when they felt or experienced the help that they were seeking. Now, each of those moments are reflected, just to review, in Star Daily. He says, finally, I collapsed. Zero moment. And then the surrender moment. I poured out love on them, which seemed to heal the hurts. He really realized he had made a mistake. And now he tried to do something about it. And then finally, before the experience, I was a callous criminal. After, I was completely healed. Power. It's even more evident, Miller. He says, zero moment. As I sat there, I began to cry like a little boy, which I suddenly realized I was. The surrender moment. I looked up toward the sky. There was nothing I wanted to do with my life. I said, God, if there's anything you want in this stinking soul, take it. Total surrender. And then he says, this power moment was almost 10 years ago, but something came into my life that day has never left. And he goes on from there, where he experiences help. King, it's zero moment. I tried to think of a way to move out of the picture without being a coward. I had reached a saturation point, surrender. In this state of exhaustion, I decided to take my problem to God. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. Surrender. Power. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I have never experienced them before. Now, to understand what is happening here, I find to go back to Kubler-Ross's death and dying before she got on that kooky streak. But she had, again, a great moment in her life where she really clarified things for a lot of people, I think. You recall, she said you go through five stages of a dying of a person who's got terminal illness. First of all, you are angry, or rather you deny, oh no, must be some mistake. I feel fine, you know. And then you get angry. Why me? Why me? I got so much to live for. Kevorkian can't handle all his business. Go to some of those people. And then bartering, well, isn't there something I can do? That, DACA, like my father, when I was in the seminary, who died from his brain was dehydrating, drying up. And when I went to see him, which wasn't often, but when I could, because we were living in different cities and we had all those restrictions, I never knew whether he was going to be lucid or not, whether he would recognize me. Red and dime, he did, you know. And so anyway, I said to him, I said, Dad, did they tell you what's wrong? He said, nah, they don't tell you anything in this hospital. I said, that's the way hospitals are. And he said, I said, your brain is drying up. Well, why didn't they tell me? I drink a lot more water. And I said, Dad, I think it's a little more complex than that, you know. But the point was, he was ready to barter, do anything that was needed, you know, for the situation. And then there finally comes that depression, that deep blue funk, you know, and that's so important because that's where I realize it's really happening. And then comes the acceptance where I say, okay, God, it's all yours. Naked I came, naked I go back, you know. And it's really a beautiful thing because those of you who work in pastoral ministry know that people want to sedate their mother. Oh, mother was such a cheerful person. Now she's totally depressed. Give her some sedation. This isn't her. This isn't her. You know? And what you have to do is facilitate, see what step she's in and facilitate the next step to help her come to it. If you sedate her, it just ruins the greatest gift in her life, to give her life back to God, you know? Well, here's the point, and Mark Searle at Notre Dame is the one I think deserves credit for this. He said that's exactly what happens in a conversion. Exactly. And he said the reason it happens is because conversion is dying to the old man and being born to the new man. It's really a spiritual terminal death. And that is always hard. The first thing that to do is say, hey, I'm all right. I came on a weekend of a priest here. Get some of these other guys who wouldn't go black in the door of a place like that. Talk to them. You know, it's denying that you need any conversion. And then you say, hey, will you get off of my case? You know? And then finally you say, well, maybe I'll begin to pray a little, you know, or something like that. You're willing to make a compromise. Then you sort of go in that blue funk and you say, yeah, there are a couple things that I maybe better quit smoking, or maybe better start to pray, or maybe I should forgive this person that I've been unable to forgive. And finally you say, okay, I'm going to do it. And the zero moment comes at the end of that, the final one, the depression, rather that when I realize I can't do it. And that brings up the whole question of the surrender. But just to go back in a zero moment once more, a good biblical example of zero moment is the prodigal son. When he's flat on his back and he realizes he's doing something no Jew would ever do, feed the swine. Or the zero moment is Jesus in the garden. Mark 14, distress and anguish came over Jesus, and he said to his disciple, the sorrow of my heart is so great, it crushes me. That was a zero moment. And he says, not my will, but thy will be done. Surrender moment, really. And that used to call deflation in depth. I always love that. Deflation in depth. And when this zero moment occurs, I know I should change. I wonder if I can change. And I've got to calculate the cost of that change. So, I should change. Can I change? What's it going to cost me? How do I go about it? And then it ends, do I or don't I go ahead and do this? Emily Griffin, who was an advertising executive and a literary critic, she was a Christian Scientist before her conversion to Catholicism. She went through a great struggle, and she has written a very small book. It's quite old now, but by that I mean at least maybe 15 years, something like that. But it's called Turning. And she got very interested in this whole question of conversion. And so she went and told about her conversion, and then she would compare it to other famous conversions like Augustine, you know, and things like that. So it's a very easy to read book on it. She talks about like C.S. Lewis's conversion and Thomas Merton's and also Ronald Knox, people like that. And she, I don't want to go into a lot of detail on her. I don't have the time, but she has a little different vocabulary. She says the first step in conversion is desire. Where I'm an alcoholic and I desire, I long to be rid of this problem. And unless that desire comes that I want to get rid of it, a lot of alcoholics deny it. That's the biggest thing. I have no problem. I can handle it. But until you desire to change. And then she says there's that dialectic where that inner dialogue, which says, what will people say if I suddenly go off and get help, you know, on this particular thing? What will they say? So it's an inner dialogue of all the problems involved. And then there's a struggle, which is a leap of faith, say, I don't give a damn what they think. Here's what I got to do. And I decide to go ahead and surrender. There's a sort of a capitulation, not to a superior force. It's a capitulation to someone who really loves. I'm capitulating to a lover, to unconditional love. Anyway, here's the way I like the way she describes the surrender moment. She said, it's a moment when all the arguments have been gone over with a fine comb, when all objections have been raised, dealt with as far as the intellect and reason can. It is a moment when all fears have been feared, all doubts have been doubted, when something within us says, if you are ever going to believe, it will be now. The now is not only now, it is now or never. I really stopped on that one to think about it, whether that was true. Because it seems to me there's always that possibility in the future. I can see what she wants to do. She was doing like Jesus did in many of those parables, pointing out the urgency of the situation. She says, my own thought is that it's most like a child taking his first step. No amount of holding the child up and moving his feet in sequence will accomplish the thing. It cannot be learned until it is done for the first time. A loving parent can provide example and encouragement, nothing more. Unless the child walks on his own, he cannot walk at all. Now, this is really a life and death decision, not only for me, but for a lot of other people. And you see so many people who have benefited from someone else's courageous decision to surrender. Bill Wilson, classic example. The ministry that he has had since that time. Let me just close here with, it'll take just enough to run us to about 12. Is that when we close at 12? Emily, L-I-E-E-M-L-E-M, getting at the end of my, just a minute. E-M-I-L-I-E and G-R-I-F-F-I-N. E-Emily. Yeah. Let me give you an example of someone who said yes to surrender. This comes from Doris Donnelly. She teaches at John Carroll University. She says, 30 years ago, a 7-year-old boy was riding between his two brothers in the back seat of a car. Suddenly, their mother, drained and distraught from the experience of her husband's abandonment and recent divorce, reached over the front seat and slammed the 7-year-old boy across the face with her hand. You! The only reason I had you, she screamed, was to keep your father. I never wanted you. I hate you. The scene was indelibly engraved on the child's memory. Over the years, the mother reinforced the sincerity of those remarks by praising the older sons and by unnecessarily and continually finding fault and blame with the youngest. She says, I saw the son many months after he made his decision to forgive. He told me, I can't tell you how many times in the last 23 years I relived the scene as a boy in that car. Thousands, probably. But recently I put myself in my mother's place for a change. Here she was, a high school graduate with no money, no job, and a family of four to support. I realized how powerless, lonely, hurt, and depressed she must have felt. I thought of the anger, the fear, the pain that must have been there. And I thought of how much I must have reminded her of the failure of her young hopes. It was the beginning of forgiveness for her, my forgiveness for her. I told her that I understood and that I loved her. We wept in each other's arms for what seemed like hours. It was the beginning of a new life for me, for us, and I would say for many other people who hear that story. Now compare that to someone who said no. On March the 2nd, 1989, I was watching, I forget, normally don't have cable, but I was at a cable set that night, and they had a primetime special on Marvin Gaye. And Gaye was a headline vocalist, as you know, for about 25 years. And his rendition at the NBA All-Star Game in 1983 is still played a lot. I mean, it was just a fantastic rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. People got so caught up into it that they began to clap in rhythm, you know, and the whole place was just moving. Marvin said afterwards, he says, before I began singing that night, I asked God for power to touch people's souls of everyone present. Well, Gaye's career began at the age of 7 when he began to sing gospel songs in his father's church in Washington, D.C. His father was a fundamentalist preacher. And somehow his father began to treat him cruelly for some reason, and hostility developed between them that continued to grow. And finally, on April the 1st, 1984, tragically, his father decided that he was to kill his son. So he shot him to death. And a year later, David Ritz, who was a friend of Marvin, wrote a biography called The Divided Soul. I always loved that title because Marvin was indeed a divided soul. You could see it from what he said so many. He was part sinner like all of us, part saint. And he was part artist, part entertainer. And he was part, you might say, macho man, and he was part gentleman. He was a divided soul in the true sense of the word. And then Ritz has something very beautiful. He says, Marvin really believed in Jesus a lot, but he could never apply the teaching of Jesus on forgiveness to his own father. In the end, it destroyed them both. That's what I mean by the life and death thing. Now, when it comes to that decision, what do we do when I find I cannot forgive? I think the only thing that, there are two things you can do. Number one, if you ever read The Hiding Place by Corrie ten Boom, she was in a Nazi prison camp. The guard in the camp used to leer at them as they were taking showers. She went all over the world, something like 50 countries after the war, preaching reconciliation. She was in Munich, Germany, giving a talk on it. After the talk, somebody came up, said, thanks for forgiveness. And she looked and couldn't mistake the guy. It was the guy. She said she couldn't take his hand. She had just given this talk on forgiveness. And suddenly she said, Lord, I can't forgive him. Help me. She said at that moment, her hand went out and she truthfully said, I forgive. She said that was the most instructive moment of my life because it taught me that that Jesus, who commanded us to love our enemies, gives us the power. And that the only way you can do it is by surrendering and saying, give me the power, and the power comes in. There's another way, and that is the paradigm shift. If you ever read All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Marie Remarque, there is a French soldier in a pit, a shell hole, trench. Well, no, it was a shell hole. Yeah. So anyway, he's taking shelter from the shelling that's going on. At that moment, a German soldier leaps in. The French soldier has, or it's a German soldier, and a French soldier leaps in. The German soldier is nothing more than a boy. He plunges his dagger, his bayonet, into the French soldier, and he watches him die. And he's dying slowly. His tongue is hanging out. He takes out his canteen and he pours some water in his mouth because suddenly he became very warm toward him. And then he finally dies and he feels terrible remorse because it's the first man he's ever killed, you know, hand to hand. And he says he saw his wallet in his pocket and he wanted to know the name of the man he killed. And he pulled it out and in there was a picture of a little girl, a very beautiful woman, obviously his wife and child. And he suddenly saw he was not an enemy. He said if we would have met in a bar, we'd probably have been great friends. And what happened at that moment, he didn't decide to love his enemies, but he went through a paradigm shift. He saw him in a new light. And that new light enabled him to forgive. And so that is the second way when people can't forgive, to help them to realize, number one, Jesus gives that power. Jesus gave a command. He gives the power, the grace to carry it out. Number two, you've got to see that person in a new light, a paradigm shift, if you will. And that is the way to the forgiveness. And when we capitulate to that, we surrender to that, it comes through. There are more things I would like to say about this, but I think this is it at the time, and we'll leave it at that. I would like for you to read this. This is firsthand in much, I could tell you a lot about this. But anyway, this is what has to happen to our society. And it's one of the things that has moved me very much, to move in the direction of small groups, which I've been moving in. So take a read this and take it to heart. I've also given you a handout here on this business about if you want to give a talk to people on forgiveness, or on conversion, you might want to use this. You can work it with young people oftentimes. And it says denial. I see no need to change, you know, and then it says identify where you are in the process. So you might be able to use that to an advantage. If any of you do not have copies of these, there's copies up here.